Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. People in the coal industry are at a crossroads. Mines are closing, and some miners and families stand to lose their benefits.
And they're just wanting to take the pension away. And we can't live without the money we worked for.
What options are there? Some laid-off miners are moving away to find work, while others are looking for new occupations.
I'm starting to get a little frustrated now, edgy, because I got like 2 months left on unemployment, and I mean, I'm not getting anything.
And we'll hear from a female coal miner who showed she could be tough enough to stand up to men in the coal industry.
I don't believe in stuff being handed to you. I think you need to work for everything you get. If it ain't worth working for, it ain't worth having, in my opinion.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. There's a unique and strong bond that comes with mining coal. Coal miners often call it a brotherhood. Our show today is about those personal connections between coal miners. When you think about it, it makes sense to lean on each other while working in dangerous conditions. And I guess the same is true for Appalachians during disasters. West Virginia is recovering from widespread flooding after storms rolled through the state on June 23rd. Governor Earl Ray Tomlin called the floods, quote, the worst in a century for some parts of the state. The hands-on reaction from folks ready to help is overwhelming, and to me, not surprising. We also have a long tradition of helping out our neighbors. I know because my hometown of Mullen suffered an epic flood in 2001. It'll be a long road, Richwood. My heart is broken for you, Ravenswood, and my people across West Virginia. But just like the sign read at Mullins after the flood, tough times don't last, but tough people do. And here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, we stand with you. Coal jobs continue to disappear in Appalachia. Some families are holding tight to the idea that coal will come back. Surprisingly, it's not the pay that they miss about the work. It's the people and those relationships. A brotherhood, they say. A place to belong. On today's show, we're going to hear from some of these miners and find out just how important this bond is. But first, let's hear from someone who's still working as a coal miner. Jeremy Brock is a miner from Eastern Kentucky.
Once you get used to it, I wouldn't do nothing else. I mean, it's just, it's a culture. I mean, it's, you know, it's brotherhood.
That brotherhood comes from a certain level of danger. Jeremy admits that there were some harrowing moments when he first started working in an underground mine.
Well, when you first go in, it'll make you nervous because, I mean, the mountains will pop and crack. It'll scare you, but after a while, you get to know the sounds. You get to know the everything around it. It'll sound like it's coming in, but it really ain't going to file. It's just the weight settling on the mountain. It'll mess with your mind for a little while.
He didn't always want to work as a miner. Years ago, he dreamed of leaving Appalachia.
You know, when I was young, I wanted to get away from it. I wanted to go away. And now when everything's hit the fan, like with the coal mines and everything like that, you know, I look at it and I'm just thinking, you know, if somebody don't stand there and do something, then it's going to die. And it breaks my heart now because, I mean, I just don't want to go nowhere else. You know, it's home.
As he got older, his connection to Eastern Kentucky grew. Now he appreciates the resilience and know-how of many people from this region.
We can do a whole lot of stuff people in the city can't do. A lot of us can farm. A lot of us are auto mechanics or anything we want to be. You know, we do it because, I mean, we ain't got what most people ain't got. You know, we just got to do it ourselves if you want something done.
But there are problems here in Appalachia, and Jeremy has experienced some of the toughest issues personally.
Well, I mean, I don't really hide it, but the drug epidemic in our area, you know, I got addicted. I was for about 5 years, you know. I've been clean now for 8 years.
He says the thing that turned his life around was his daughter, Kaitlyn. When she was born, Jeremy says he went clean.
That's my world. I got a little boy now, too. He just turned one in May. Once you get a kid, that's what you live for. You know, the coal miners go underground. They don't do it for fun. You know, people say they do it for money. That's a lie. You know, they got a family. They got kids. They got a wife. They got to provide for. That's why they do it. Right. You know, and it's just family's important to the country person.
Family is what Jeremy says pulled him out of addiction. He now insists that there is a future for anyone who is struggling. He's been there.
And it can be done. You know, I know a lot of people it's done. I done it. You know, you just got to put your nose down and go, you know, and don't look back.
Jeremy Brock's story about camaraderie and friendship in the mines isn't anything new, but usually the brotherhood stories come from members of the unions. In Kentucky, where Jeremy mines, there are no union mines. This next story comes from McDowell County, West Virginia, from Buck Wade. He talks about how the United Mine Workers of America provided a bond so strong that it helped unite blacks and whites 60 years ago. Buck Wade is a 90-year-old former coal miner, and growing up, he was surrounded by mountains, hollers, and most of all, coal. The Humans of Central Appalachia Project caught up with Wade in his home in Keystone, West Virginia, where he spent most of his adult life.
I was born and raised at Ekman. That was a small coal camp. I guess it was around 600 or 700 people. Nobody lived around in that area but coal miners and their families.
Wade's family came to West Virginia on foot before he was born. Both his mother and father walked to Ekman from North Carolina in search of work after word got back from other relatives that there were jobs available working in the coal mines. Like many families in McDowell County coal mines, Wade's was black. Notably, Wade says the most of the related trouble they experienced because of their race came from the coal company rather than other miners.
See, a lot of time company discriminates against people. They'll make things to get a difference between you. Because I was told this, I don't know how true it was, but I believe it. They say when they first start to bringing blacks, when they first start to go in the mines, say the companies want to bring them out. The union had just started to get in getting organized. So the companies figured that if the whites struck, they could get the blacks to keep working. Yeah. So they put the word out everywhere that they were hiring, and that may be how it got down in Virginia, down in North Carolina, down in there where my dad and them come from. But what they did was, when the blacks got to working with the whites, when the whites struck, the company was surprised the blacks struck with the whites, because the blacks made the same money that the whites made. And when the whites said, well, I ain't gonna work no more, I ain't gonna work for this, the blacks said, well, I ain't either. So they followed them all off. So that's why the company, see, the company bought on a whole lot of stuff with the Ball and Phelps men and all that stuff. It was a war back here years ago.
Wade was a proud union member during his time in the mines, working as a team with the other men. Wade began his career in the coal mines young. He believed in the promise of good work for all those who wanted it. But then, in the slump of the 1960s, he hit a snag.
I got laid off. I got laid off in the mines back in the 50s. In the 60s, I mean. I got laid off. I stayed off for 2 years. And I went to the city and worked. I went to New York, and then I went to Columbus, Ohio, and I worked up in there. I'd come home at Christmas time, and my local union, the men that I worked with at Keystone, they would bring to my house a basket and with oranges, apples, ham, turkey, what the working members that were working had contributed to, as well as our local union, and they made it available to every one of us that had been laid off. They never forgot. Union people don't never forget each other.
Wade eventually got his job at the mine back and went on to be elected mayor of the city of Keystone 3 times. There are a lot of miners like Buck Wade out there, ones who have been laid off and supported by unions until they got back on their feet. But as the number of union mines as well as coal jobs in general decreases, stories like his are becoming less and less common. Looking back to the ways union supported workers in the past, it begs the question, how will miners like Wade be supported moving forward? You can see a photo of Buck Wade on our website at wvpublic.org. Thanks again to Malcolm Wilson with the Humans of Central Appalachia Facebook page for the audio of that interview. By the way, Malcolm says his project just celebrated its one-year anniversary and just hit 25,000 likes. It's one of the fastest-growing Facebook pages of its kind. Malcolm expects it to surpass the Humans of London Facebook page next year. When we come back, we're going to check in with some of those retired union miners to find out how the closures and bankruptcies are impacting their lives. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
We've been talking about the tight relationships that come with working as a coal miner. Some of the closeness often comes with being part of a union. By sticking together, the UMWA negotiated for better pay, better working conditions, health care, and more. Now, some of the benefits of that work are in jeopardy. 22,000 retired coal miners and dependents could lose health benefits by the end of 2016. Congress introduced legislation that would save those benefits, but it's yet to be taken to a vote. Recently, thousands of active and retired coal miners and their families from seven states came to Lexington, Kentucky for a United Mine Workers of America rally. One of those attending the rally was Becky Gardner. Gardner's husband and mother-in-law are both at risk of losing their benefits.
Just have a set income. Milk and bread keeps getting higher, and they're just wanting to take the pension away. And we can't live without the money we worked for. We're not wanting a handout. We're just wanting what we work for, what our husbands has worked for.
Becky said her main concern is for her mother-in-law, who's not in the best of health. If she loses her health benefits and her husband's pension, Becky says it could be really difficult for their family. A miner's job once provided insurance and stability, a promise that workers would have retirement and health benefits for their families. Now, that promise is being compromised. Why? Carol often reports that the fundamental issue is that as coal companies file for bankruptcy, the first thing they seek to shed are worker benefits.
Jennings Harrison worked in a coal mine for 36 years, over which time he accumulated back problems, neck problems, carpal tunnel in his wrist, and precancerous nodules on his lungs.
If we didn't have the health care, we'd be hurting.
By this time next year, not having health care could be a reality for him, though. That's because Harrison worked for Peabody Energy, then Patriot Coal. Both companies filed for bankruptcy in the last 4 years. A little background. In 2007, Peabody created Patriot Coal. Peabody assigned Patriot 13% of its coal reserves and 40% of its health care liabilities. In a nutshell,
Peabody was attempting to shed an enormous amount of its existing liabilities by creating Patriot.
That's West Virginia University law professor Patrick McGinley in a Skype interview. McGinley is co-editor of a treatise on coal law and regulation.
Whether or not Patriot would survive or not was a question, but there's a fairly good argument that that's what Peabody was attempting to do at that time.
As part of a union contract, miners who put in 20 or more years were promised lifelong health benefits. But when Patriot filed for bankruptcy in 2012, then again in 2015, a judge granted Patriot's request to shed retiree benefits. The United Mine Workers of America stepped in and negotiated $400 million from Patriot and Peabody. The companies came up about $100 million short. Those Band-Aid funds will run out by the end of this calendar year. Without health care benefits, Harrison said he could be forced to declare bankruptcy himself.
I mean, after working all your life in the mines and it was promised, you know, health care and stuff and pension and stuff, it'd be a shame to lose that, you know, when you really need it.
Harrison is just one of almost 22,000 retirees and their dependents from seven states who are slotted to lose their benefits by the end of the year.
They're going to have to make some very, very difficult and frightening choices.
That's Phil Smith, Director of Communications and Governmental Affairs for the United Mine Workers of America.
Are they they going to be able to buy the drugs that they need or pay the rent? Are they going to be able to get the health care that they need, go see the doctor, or buy food?
In 1946, the United States government and the UMWA signed an agreement that guaranteed miners with 20 or more years on the job benefits for life. Smith said this is the only such agreement that has ever been signed between the U.S. government and a union.
What is required at this point is legislation that we are looking at in Congress that would preserve these health care benefits for those people who have lost or will lose them as a result of the bankruptcies.
In December of 2015, a bipartisan bill aimed at protecting miners' health care and pensions cleared both chambers of Congress. That legislation was blocked by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. It is not completely clear why McConnell opposes the bill, although it is well known that McConnell has repeatedly clashed with the UMWA. An emailed statement from a McConnell spokeswoman said that he, quote, has been and remains committed to helping ensure the retirement security of our nation's retirees, including coal miners.
If Congress does not act, if Congress fails to act to do its job to keep the promise that the United States government made to these retirees 70 years ago, then the money will run out and those folks will be without their health care because there is no other money to take care of it.
Five major coal producers in the United States have sought bankruptcy protection in the last 5 years. Each time they sought to shed employee benefits. McGinley again.
Members of Congress, politicians, it's their responsibility to fix laws when they're misused in the sort of way that many believe have occurred, not only with regard to Peabody and Patriot and other corporate entities as well in the coal industry and other forms of business. Congress really has to take a look at bankruptcy laws and fix it.
Peabody did not respond to a request for comment, and the PR company who worked for Patriot declined comment. No other Patriot spokesperson could be found. For Appalachia Health News, I'm Carol Lofton.
Appalachia Health News is a project of West Virginia Public Broadcasting with support from the Benedum Foundation.
We just heard some impacts of Peabody and Patriot's bankruptcy filing. Next, we're going to hear what's happening to some union miners up in Greene County, Pennsylvania, as Alpha Natural Resources filed for bankruptcy and the workers have been stuck without jobs. Greene County is right on the West Virginia border, and it's the number one coal-producing county in the U.S. But times are changing there. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has been following the impact of coal's decline in Pennsylvania. In this report, Reed talked with coal miners who still have a strong bond, even after the mines have closed.
In November, the word came down. The Emerald Mine No. 1 in Waynesburg was closing. The mine belongs to Alpha Natural Resources, a large coal company that, like most other big coal companies, is in the midst of bankruptcy. One night, a few months after it closed, many of the miners who lost their jobs meet in a large, well-lit hall. More than 100 people are there to see presentations about job opportunities they'd be qualified for. One of these is Derek Corcoran, a big, burly 31-year-old. He's been working in mines for 12 years. He remembered the day of the layoffs.
Right before Thanksgiving, this past Thanksgiving, they laid off. I think it was close to 200, maybe a little over 200 miners.
Was that a surprise?
No, they were talking about it for a couple years and just finally come along, you know, and it actually happened. So.
The crowd is mostly men, though some of the miners have brought their families with them. They take their seats and hear a series of speakers. One of them is the local state representative, Pam Snyder. She tells how she'd been laid off after administrations in the state capital had changed back when she worked in state government. And she said it worked out for her, and it'll probably work out for them, too.
Through the struggles, something better came from it. So I want you to know tonight, something better will come for you.
There are representatives from county agencies and technical schools, former miners who now work in fields like computer coding and private security. One of the speakers is Blair Zimmerman. He's a Greene County commissioner. He used to be a coal miner. And he says he'd been laid off many times before.
We always knew we were going to get back to work.
He points to a pin on his lapel. He says it was his 40-year pin from the UMWA. the United Mine Workers of America, the union these miners belong to.
You guys don't want to be bullshit, and you don't want that. And I know I didn't want that when I worked there. So the reality is, you know, these 40-year pins are going to be hard to come by.
Zimmerman says some would be lucky enough to get a job at the Cumberland Mine, another local mine owned by Alpha Natural Resources.
And I hope sooner than later. But a lot of you aren't going to get back to the mines. That's just the way it's going to happen.
After the speeches are over, the meeting breaks up. One of the speakers is Dave Searock. He left the coal mine to work as a recruiter for a private industry group. He lays out the challenge faced by the people in this room.
It's tough because the hardest transition is you're going from a job where you made six figures, and probably the highest job you're going to get in Fayette or Greene County is $20,000, $30,000 a year. If you're lucky, you might get one hit 40, but you're never going to hit 80 to 100.
This meeting is the first event held by a group calling itself Career Opportunities After Layoff. Acronym COAL. Get it? The group was started by two Emerald miners to help their fellow laid-off miners get jobs. One of the guys who organized the group is Dave Hathaway. He's not dressed like the other miners. Today, he's wearing a dress shirt and tie. Hathaway says he's not holding out hope for getting rehired in the coal industry. He's on the list to be transferred to the Cumberland mine, but right now he's number 70 in seniority, so his odds are small. He says he's applied to 50 places, all online.
From prison to casino, gas field, just anywhere.
And any bites?
Zero. Not one phone call from any.
Overall, he's happy with the way tonight's event has turned out. He's particularly impressed with one of the speakers, a rep for the Carpenters Union, who encouraged the miners to apply for an internship that paid $40,000 during training, and more once the training was over. All the miners file out of the meeting hall. It's March. For most of them, their unemployment runs out in 2 months.
So as we just heard, former miner Dave Hathaway has teamed up with some former coal mine buddies. They're hoping that by pulling together, they will find new employment opportunities for each other. We'll find out what happens to the former Emerald miners later in the show. First, we wanted to bring the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier into the studio to talk about his long-term report on what the miners are doing since the Emerald mine closed. Hi, Reed. Thanks for coming on to share more about the situation.
Hi, Jessica.
Hi. So, a lot has changed for miners across Appalachia. We hear about the war on coal, tighter regulations coming from Washington, D.C. Do the miners you spoke with who used to work at the Emerald Mine feel that President Obama's EPA is pushing them out of work?
I feel like, yeah, I mean, in general, they definitely do. It's sort of like a kind of an easy and obvious target. In this particular part of Greene County, there was a coal-fired power plant that closed a couple years ago. And part of the reason they closed that the company cited was, at least the message that got out to the community, was that it is in part due to the new regulations that the EPA has imposed. And this was even before the Clean Power Plan came out. But I think a lot of miners also just are kind of aware that the general movement of the nation, the way we get our energy, is moving away from coal and towards things like gas. And they see it in their backyard, too. I mean, this part of Greene County, like other parts of Appalachia, there's a lot of gas drilling there. And, you know, it's kind of ironic that as the coal industry in Greene County has kind of gone downhill, the gas industry there, too, is really going downhill, too, because of low gas prices. So it's sort of like a perfect storm for the folks who are getting their job, who are losing their jobs, because the very industry that's taking their jobs away is also itself going away too, or at least there aren't jobs opening up in the natural gas field right now.
Hmm. Yeah, and along those same lines, Dave Hathaway and his former co-worker Bob Wilson formed the COAL group, the coal group, Career Opportunities After Layoff, like you reported on, and the group's trying to help miners get jobs in other fields. Have they found it easy to find the right resources in this kind of endeavor?
Well, they have been able to, you know, pretty quickly find names and numbers of county agencies or training schools or resources to get people jobs. You know, there's this whole social safety net in these rural counties that is kind of there to spring into action to help these guys. And they have. And as they began their research, they realized just how difficult this would be. I mean, they could get these names and numbers of agencies and training places, but, you know, to find the kind of salary that they were making, $80,000, $100,000 a year, that was hard. I mean, that was enough money to raise a family on, buy some extra things like cars or guns or fishing rods, or take their kids out on special trips that they wouldn't normally be able to afford. So that's been, I think, the key difficulty for these guys.
Did Dave say that he always wanted to work in the mines?
Dave, actually, no. I mean, he kind of comes from a mining family. His dad worked at that specific, the Emerald Mine. And he said when he was younger, he didn't want to work there. His father took him on a tour of the mine in his 20s when his dad was working there. And he said, you know, he didn't think it was for him. And I'll just play a little sound here.
I didn't want nothing to do with it. I said, this is totally ridiculous. It's insane.
Why was it insane?
Just conditions. Like, I mean, it was just, I don't know. I mean, I didn't really have any want to do it. At the time, I was delivering copiers, making like 13, 14 bucks an hour. And I had my first kid. And, I mean, the money just wasn't cutting it.
So Dave took a training course and got hired as a contractor for a construction company that works underground in mines. And he got his experience in that job. And with a little help from his dad, eventually got hired on to the Emerald Mine. And here's Dave again.
Money was the main, you know, and insurance was the main reason why I did it.
Because you had the kid.
Yeah. But once I got in there, man, that's the greatest job I ever had. I mean, the guys, I made a lot of great friends, like Bob here.
And that's Dave Hathaway talking about Bob Wilson. So, Reed, did Bob tell you his story about when he first landed a job in the mines?
Yeah, and Bob had a different kind of story than a lot of the folks that I met in Greene County. He really worked his way up from the outside. He started as a contractor for a company that built belt lines. And he says he got his break at the mine during a miner's vacation when everybody else was away, and the mine was shut down for maintenance.
And I was shaking hands and, you know, just really working hard. And a couple of guys out there in the belt department talked to me, and they said, we'd like to have you as a worker. I said, well, I'd like to work here. And they told me to put an application in, and that's how it started.
And I think, as you can hear there, he really liked doing that kind of work.
Yeah, and the Emerald Mine was a union mine, right? So at the time, he was a union miner?
That's right, and he really loved the stability of working in a union mine.
And you were actually a part of something, being a part of the UMWA. When I first got in there, I was like, I'm part of something, you know? You know, I couldn't plan anything as a contractor. You have a phone that you have to carry with you, and it has to be on. And you get a phone call, you better be in that truck, you know? But so it really felt nice to actually be a part of something.
It's so interesting. And so now Bob and Dave are basically organizing miners to pursue new trades and helping them look for jobs now that their mines have closed down. And meanwhile, these miners have families to support. Like so many people across Appalachia, I'm sure these miners are anxious right now.
Yeah, they are definitely worried. And some miners, are just doing what they have to do. And if they have to leave the area, they are. A friend of Dave's, Ted Fink, is moving to Tennessee to take a job, and I talked to Ted about it and Ted's wife. And you know, he got a job in a manufacturing plant in Tennessee. But for Dave, that's not really an option. He's got a kid in the area, and about a week after he found out he was getting laid off, Dave's wife gave him some news that kind of bears on his decision of whether or not to leave or stay.
So it was like I get on unemployment and she's like, we're having a baby. I mean, it wasn't like, yeah, I'm happy, we were trying, but it would have been nice to have a, you know, $75,000 job to make things happen, you know. But, I mean, I'm starting to get a little frustrated now, edgy, because I got like 2 months left on unemployment, and I mean, I'm not getting anything.
Would they go back underground, you think?
That's a funny question, because they say that if, you know, their old mine would call back, they'd go back in a heartbeat. But if they had to start over and learn a whole new place and a whole new set of people and rules and, you know, sort of the culture of a new place, they might not. Here's Bob talking about that.
I think I'd speak for both of us. If we could go back to what we were doing at that mine, you know, now it's gone, you miss it, yeah, we would go back tomorrow. But as far as going to another mine or new mine, I really don't, I don't think so.
But as far as job retraining, you know, there's retraining, but in fields like trucking, which are, you know, kind of problematic for folks who have families and don't want to travel too far. And so in any kind of, you know, union trade or trade school, that's a kind of a, it's a long, slow process to kind of get rehired. So there's some kind of structural barriers to these guys finding new opportunities to get well-paying jobs. And, you know, the fact is it's kind of hard for them psychologically, because there really are no jobs like coal mining jobs out there for them, and there won't be, and that's kind of a tough pill to swallow.
Reed Frazier is a reporter with the Allegheny Front, and he's been working on a long-term reporting project that explores the story of what happens to some miners when their mines close down. The Emerald Mine, where Dave Hathaway and Bob Wilson used to work, is in western Pennsylvania. Let's pick it back up with Reed's next story in this series. We'll see what happens to them as they try to pursue jobs in carpentry and other fields and try to help their former coal miners find work.
Bob Wilson and Dave Hathaway are on a mission to get a job after the mine they worked at, the Emerald No. 1, was shut down. They've started a group to help other miners find jobs, but there's not much work in Greene County, where they're from. They don't want to leave the area, as some are doing. So today, they're at the Carpenters Union. The union's headquarters are out by the Pittsburgh International Airport. The union would pay them pretty well while they train, and they could make good money once the training is over. At the union hall, Bob and Dave walk over to a counter where they're greeted by a receptionist. Bob tells her they're here to apply for the union's training program.
Okay, so I need to see your driver's license and $25 for the testing fee.
They give over their IDs, and the woman fills out some paperwork. She explains there are only a few times a year to take the test to get into the training program.
So the specialty programs, okay, they bring a class in once per year every June, okay? Commercial carpentry.
In a separate room, they sit in front of computers and enter their past work history, where they went to high school, yeah. The equipment they know how to operate.
So I just put Builder's Guild up here where...
To lighten things up, Dave suggests the two have a race to see who finishes their application first. When they're done, the receptionist says they'll need to come back for a test and an interview. The whole thing takes less than half an hour. In the parking lot, they seem relieved. They at least started the process. This is, after all, their best chance of a job paying anything like the 80 to 100 grand they could make at the coal mine.
Well, I think we played a couple good angles in there.
Yeah.
We gave him the cards from the coal committee. She seemed interested. Dave told her a little bit about what we're about.
A few minutes later, a couple other guys come out of the building. They were also applying to get into the same training program, and they're also from Greene County. When Bob finds this out, he hands them a card from their coal committee. It's got a picture of a miner on it and their phone numbers.
Are you offering something?
We're trying to organize stuff to get guys better, you know, longer benefits for unemployment, more money for retraining,
okay,
for schooling and stuff like that, and trying to create an information network to help other coal miners to get jobs again.
Yeah.
He is there.
Affected by that.
They talked to Anthony Weiss. He's working with the coal industry as a contractor. That's not as good a job, either for pay or benefits, as the union job. But still, his story sounds a lot like Bob and Dave's.
They cut us down to 4 days a week, and then, you know, they started cutting our hours back 6 days, you know, 6 hours a day and all that stuff, and just can't live on that. I mean, used to working 12-hour days, you know, 6-7 days a week, and it's just dying out, and got to find something else to do.
Bob tells the men to visit the website, that it has updates on free resources like a food pantry and social services.
All right, y'all have a nice day.
Good luck to you.
You too.
They say goodbye and head back to Greene County. Since 2011, more than 30,000 coal miners in the U.S. have lost their jobs. About one in four miners in Pennsylvania have lost their jobs since then. This is a collapsing industry, and most don't expect the industry to ever come back to its former levels. Bob Wilson and Dave Hathaway are among the many miners who lost their jobs when the Emerald Mine in Greene County closed last year. Now Bob and Dave are looking for work. They'd like to get into a training program run by the Carpenters Union, which would pay them while they train. To get into the union, they had to take a test that measures basic math skills. I catch up with them just after they'd taken it at an outdoor shopping center in Pittsburgh. Bob says they did pretty well, but there were a few other guys taking their test who didn't.
You could tell they didn't pass. They come out and they're like, oh, we'll send you a letter, let you know how you did. And then, you know, for us, they were like, you know, we come out one time, they shook our hand and just said, congratulations, you passed your test.
Bob is feeling good. They had worked hard to get the interview. They started a group to help other miners find jobs, and they're hoping some of the work they've done will also pay off for them. After they had taken the carpenter's test, they went to the Electrical Workers Union Hall to fill out papers for that apprenticeship program. The hustle of presenting themselves to so many different places is wearing on them, Bob says.
You know, it's like a full-time job looking for work right now. The day before, you know, yesterday, we took our civil service exams in Pittsburgh here. Like, hour and a half drive with traffic and stuff.
The civil service exam is for a job at a prison. There's a high-security state prison a few miles away from Bob's house. It's one of Greene County's largest employers.
So how would you feel about working in a prison?
You're inside a building, so there's less weather. I don't have to go underground anymore and worry about stuff falling on me, per se, or the terrible weather and the beating up your body. You don't have to really worry about that in a prison, but you do have to deal with the attitudes.
Bob has a friend who works at the state prison in Greene County. He says it's high stress, but it's a job, and it's nothing if not steady. He says it's not like they're going to close the prison. Besides, the options are limited.
We're not even, what he's looking at, you're not even going to be able to grab something that's going to match your unemployment and health care, and that's really scary. You can't even find something that matches unemployment.
One thing he says would make a big difference for the miners is to get unemployment benefits extended past the normal 6 months. Bob and Dave have read stories about how a few years ago, workers laid off during the recession had their unemployment extended. They wanted the same thing for coal workers.
Where's our bailout money? You know, just, and it's not just a handout like we need our houses rebuilt. We just need to help to get a good paying job. We just need unemployment extended for 2 years so these people can train for a good job. That's all we're asking for.
There's just over a month to go before unemployment runs out. And Bob's worried, not just for him, but for the rest of the people who worked at the Emerald Mine.
Another month, it's going to get real bad when everybody loses everything. They're already selling everything. And they're not even out of unemployment a month from now. When they all lose all of their income, I wouldn't be surprised if they even seen a fatality or somebody took their own life.
That's a little dramatic, but they've already seen it happening. One guy they worked with got a DUI. They say he always drank a lot, and now that he's got no job to hold on to, he's been drinking even more. What should be done to help these people out? There is federal money for retraining coal miners, but that money has to pass through government agencies and then gets farmed out to community colleges and nonprofits that specialize in training, and that takes months, maybe even a year, before it can help. In this year's presidential race, coal mining has come up. Donald Trump says he's going to bring back the industry, though he's short on details as to how he'd do that. Hillary Clinton has a $30 billion plan for coal communities that includes retraining coal miners, though she caught flack in coal country when she said her national energy policy would put coal mines out of business. A few weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Labor turned down the Emerald Miners' request for an unemployment extension. So what can people like Bob and Dave do? Bob says a lot. He says if we're going to use more wind and solar, why not get former coal miners to install it?
The coal miners are some of those versatile people on the planet. You know, we've all ran equipment. Me and Dave here, we've been belt repairmen together, welding, fabricating, cutting torches, building belt drives from the ground up. I mean, $1 million belt drives. And Dave's, you know, went all the way outside running dozer and stuff. I mean, we're versatile. We can do this stuff with a little bit of help.
This month, Bob and Dave hear back from the Carpenters Union. In the meantime, they're cutting grass to earn a little money. And Dave says he may get hired back to the company's Cumberland mine. He's number 25 on the waiting list. The baby his wife Ashley is carrying is due in September. They're having a boy. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. I'm Reed Frazier. Kara Holsapple returns next week. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on the environment. More at AlleghenyFront.org. Reed Frazier says Bob and Dave's unemployment benefits have run out. Right now, they're earning money by cutting grass. Also, the Allegheny Front did reach out to Alpha Natural Resources for this report, but the company declined to comment. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear about a woman who worked in the coal mines. You are Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we've been talking about the culture of coal mining. We heard laid-off miners talking about missing what they call the brotherhood. That brotherhood doesn't leave much room for women, though. In fact, it was a long-held superstition among miners that it was bad luck for a woman to even enter a mine. But now we're going to hear from Tanya James. Her family worked as coal miners for three generations. She started working in the mines in 1979, when only about 1 in 100 coal miners were women. She recently sat down for StoryCorps with her daughters to talk about why she took the job.
My dad passed away when I was 17. My mother still had to take care of the family, and so she decided to take the mining class, and I'd go down with her every day. Instructor said, well, if you're going to come down here every day, you might as well take the class too. She started in the mines, and 6 months later, I started in.
When I was younger, I remember watching you, Gary, go to work, wondering if he's going to come back home that night or not.
I understand how you girls felt. I know what it feels like to have your mother in the mines, and it could be a little rough. So I was pretty protective of her. Even though I knew she could protect herself, I seen her pick up a guy by the neck. So she was a tough cookie. And I was taught at an early age from my mother, if you don't fight for yourself, ain't nobody else going to do it for you. You know, when I was hired, a lot of people thought the only reason women wanted into mines was to find them a man. And for the first 6 months, you're not allowed to be by yourself. I remember one time they sent me and this one man back into a part of the mines that nobody goes into, and he started getting a little too friendly. I told him, don't touch me. Well, the third time he approached me, he put his hands on my shoulders, and when he did, I just brought my knee up. I hit him true and hit the mark, and he went down, rolled and cried and throwed up. He got the point. He never bothered me again. You had to make them respect you, and you had to prove yourself daily. But I don't believe in stuff being handed to you. I think you need to work for everything you get. If it ain't worth working for, it ain't worth having, in my opinion.
It kind of brought us up a little the same way.
I think you've proved to me more than once that you're not gonna let anybody run over you, and I'm proud of you for it.
You're an extraordinary woman, and I would like to be one day, too.
Tanya James was with her daughters, Michelle Paugh and Trista James. The conversation was recorded by StoryCorps in Morgantown, West Virginia. Tanya spent more than 20 years in the mines and recently became the first woman in her union to hold a seat on the International Executive Board. Today we've heard from miners and former miners. Many of them are trying to decide what to do next in a world of declining coal jobs. We've also heard about some miners who are trying to organize to help former miners find new work. There's also a group of organizations working to retrain laid-off miners and get them back to work. For this next story, we check in with Brian Fields. It's his job to retrain miners in eastern Kentucky. He works for LKLP, Community Action Council, a private nonprofit corporation that's been around since the War on Poverty back in the 1960s. Brian says nearly 70% of the work he does is helping laid-off miners relocate to find new jobs outside of eastern Kentucky. For those who choose to stay, he says there are some success stories.
We have had some luck with people, I mean, totally changing their career field here. We've had people become barbers, law enforcement, nurses.
He says a lot of the former miners he talks to are ready to get back to work, and they're anxious with how tough that journey can be.
Very determined, a little bit shaken because they don't know what they're going to do, but they're quite easy to work with. You don't really have to motivate them. They're very motivated to work.
But a lot of the miners do opt to leave eastern Kentucky so they can find a job with higher wages, similar to what they earned as miners. Brian says it is hard to see them move.
Most of them are second, third generation miners. They've grown up around work. These guys and gals, believe it or not, got a lot of work in them. Their anxiety is from working so hard to drawing unemployment. They can't stand it. They want to get back to work ASAP. And the challenge for us is trying to find suitable employment in the area.
Brian Fields helps retrain laid-off coal miners to do jobs that include working on heating and air units, doing electrical work, and welding. He works with people in Leslie, Knott, Letcher, and Perry counties in Kentucky. We've posted a link on our website where you can learn more about LKLP Community Action Council, where Brian works. Brian's interview was recorded by Malcolm Wilson with the Humans of Central Appalachia Facebook page. Gary Bentley spent 12 years as an underground coal miner in Kentucky before he was laid off in 2013. He started writing about his experiences to try and combat the stereotypes about coal miners that he sees in the media and pop culture. You can find his stories in a blog called In the Black on the Rural News website, The Daily Yonder. In his column, he shares his stories of his career in the mines. Next, we're going to hear Gary read one of his stories. It's about a time when he found friendship in an old-timer. It's called, I'll Show You Everything and Teach You Even More.
I wiped the sweat from my brow as I drilled the last roof bolt in Kemper, Kentucky. My forearms were tight and the muscles were swollen as I finished my final shift. My work with Frontier in Pike County, Kentucky, had came to an end when we completed construction of the shaft. It was time to move on or travel with a crew to a new job in Illinois. Some men talked about going to Chicago. Happy Mill said he would be asking to take a position in California, working on a new underground transportation unit. I was just thankful my time with Frontier was complete. I dreamed of continuing as a miner in eastern Kentucky. I knew of a mine contracting company that functioned more like a temp agency. Star Energy had a good reputation for putting miners to work, and that is what I needed. I stopped by their office on my way home, pleased to see an old classmate from high school behind the front desk. Tasha was very friendly and quick to find an open position for me at a nearby mine. 3 days later, I pulled into the new mine's gravel parking lot at 5 a.m., I laced up my Matterhorn boots, tightened my mining belt, turned on my cap light, strapped on my knee pads, and grabbed my dinner bucket. I was nervous. I knew what it was like working underground, but there would be new people and a new environment. Going to a new mine is much like the first day of school, if the school had a history of mass shootings. You walk in knowing you may not go home. I climbed the steps up to the mine office, the metal stairs teetering side to side, and the landing shifting with each step. The office, it was really an old single-wide trailer that had been stripped and converted, with changing rooms in the back. The trailer eerily resembled the trailer where my cousin used to cook meth. The small office was filthy. Everything was covered in coal dust. The man behind the desk was weathered, his hair completely white, his face wrinkled. He was agile, though, no delay. He stood up quick, wearing the mining uniform just like all of the other miners. "I'm Terry. Are you Gary Bentley?" "Yes, I'm Gary. They said you all needed a belt shoveler." "Yeah, we need a lot of things around here. What kind of experience you have?" "I've shoveled belts, drilled and loaded powder, construction work on belt lines, about it." "You got your certified card, right?" "Yes, here's my card and my ATF certification for transporting explosives, if you need me for that." "All right, you'll be shoveling today. Rio will show you the mine entrance." Just as he finished, a tall, wiry man came walking in. I guessed his age to be 60. He had long gray hair pulled into a ponytail. He was smoking as he walked through the door. He was usually smoking, as it turned out. His gait was that of an old man in a nursing home trying to strut through the halls like John Travolta in Grease. "Terry, I heard you were retiring," the man said. "What you gonna do with all that money when you retire?" "Well, Rio, I've thought about it. I think I'll buy me a miniature miner." He gestured with his hands to be about the size of a matchbox car. "And a block of the best cocaine I can find. Then I'm going to chase that little SOB around with a straw until I die." Both men chuckled. Rio patted Terry on the back and walked past me. Terry nodded in my direction. Their eyes met. And apparently Rio knew he should acknowledge my being there. "I'm Rio. You the sucker going with me today?" The scent on his breath was familiar. It was the same as my father. Cheap beer and cheaper vodka. "Follow me. I'll show you everything and teach you even more." At the drift mouth, we climbed into the rail car that hauled supplies into the mine. "You're going to help me first, then I'll take you back up to the airlocks. You from around here?" I told Rio that I was from Whitesburg, and he went on to talk about a man I didn't know. Apparently, Rio traded horses with the man, bought some moonshine, and somehow lost his wife to the man. The man he was speaking of lived in Whitesburg, and because I did as well, Rio expected I should know him too. I sat in the seat next to Rio, knees to my chin, as the car moved through the mine. "Now you gotta watch your head, it gets pretty low in here. Some of these places are 32 inches and shrinking." We'd been traveling on the car for more than an hour. The only light for the man trip came from our cap lights. I was disoriented by the quick turns through the mine that were followed by steep descents. I was hoping Rio wouldn't drop me off alone, as Hawk did back at Blue Diamond. I knew I wouldn't be able to find my way out. When we arrived at the end of the rail, Rio informed me. "This is the end of the track. Mine's close to be finished up. They're pulling back the pillars, so I doubt we'll see any more new rail put in. And I ain't packing this shit by hand, so we'll just unload here and let them figure it out." Rio was the supply man. His job was to haul timbers, roof bolts, oil, parts for repairs, rock dust, and anything else that was needed from the outside to the working face. He had to unload at least 100 timbers by hand. Now timbers, small trees that vary from 6 to 12 inches in diameter, cut 36 to 60 inches in length. That's why I was with him, and not shoveling belt like Terry had wanted. Rio needed a young man with a strong back who didn't know enough to say no. It was hard work. Bending over with only 42 inches between the floor and the roof of the mine, I couldn't imagine what kind of pain this would have been if I were Rio's age. I continued unloading until the job was complete, then climbed back into the seat of the rail car. Rio offered me a soda and a candy bar, but I declined. I was soaked with sweat, breathing heavy, and felt like if I ate anything, I would just throw it back up on the ride out. As we neared the entrance of the mine, I could see daylight seeping through the cracks of the portal doors. I stepped off the rail car to open the doors, wading through mud above the top of my boots and struggling to make each step successful. I heard a click, looked over my shoulder to see Rio had fired up another cigarette. Smoking and underground mining can be a volatile mix. That's why regulations required us to leave lighters and cigarettes on the surface. But Rio didn't seem to be worried, as he motioned for me to jump back on the car.
That was Gary Bentley, who worked 12 years as a coal miner. He's currently a production supervisor at a Dixie Cup factory in Lexington, Kentucky. So, we'd like to know, what do you think? Are there jobs in industry that could put miners back to work in your community? What would you like to see come to the area? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag MyAppalachia. Let us know what could help build these economies. You can also email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Allegheny Front, WEKU in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and the Humans of Central Appalachia Facebook page. Music in today's show was provided by Alan Cathead Johnston, Marisa Anderson, Anna and Elizabeth, Ben Townsend, David Mumford, and Hank Williams Jr. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Kara Lofton. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
A country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.